Welcome to Leadership Amplified, and my guest today is Dr. Michelle Evans, who's Associate Professor in Leadership at the Faculty of Business and Economics at the University of Melbourne, and she specialises in the areas of Indigenous leadership and entrepreneurship. She's also co-founder of the award-winning Murra Indigenous Business Masterclass program based at Melbourne Business School, where she completed her PhD. Dr. Evans has been awarded four Australian Research Council competitive grants and a Fulbright scholarship and is widely published in her area. She teaches predominantly at senior executive and postgraduate levels. Prior to academia, Dr. Evans was founder of the Willen Centre for Indigenous Arts and Cultural Development at the Victorian College of Arts. Together with her research, this provides a unique combination of professional experience in management, community engagement, and facilitation in Indigenous leadership and policy development. She has been consulted by the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, OECD, and other public institutions, as well as leading Australian organisations in development of their reconciliation action plans. Dr. Evans believes that the path to Indigenous self-determination is economic independence. In addition to establishing Murra, Dr. Evans has also established other initiatives designed to support Indigenous entrepreneurship, including Wallan Mayingu, Indigenous Entrepreneurship Pop-Up Hub, Indigenous Business Month, and she's collaborated on the Native Title Operation and Management Training Program with the National Native Title Council. Michelle, welcome to the podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you, Karen, and really fantastic to be speaking with you today.
Yeah, amazing. So tell us about the Michelle Evans leadership journey. What was it that inspired you to develop leadership and bring us up to date on what's happening for you?
Yeah, well, let me start by acknowledging the country on which I'm joining you with from. I'm based on Wiradjuri country on the north side of the Milawabilla or the Murray River in what was really well known as Bungambarotha, a meeting place now known by the name Albury in New South Wales. And acknowledging elders past and present here and the incredible efforts to maintain culture and connection to country. I guess thinking about leadership and place and my life story, if I go back to where my idea of leadership came from, I was very much always in that feeling that I knew, had a vision for what needed to be done, and was pretty confident in being able to enroll people into that vision quite early, whether it be to set up a club or to do a play or to create some sort of band of people together to do something new from early childhood on, really. I've got two younger siblings and they were subjected to a lot of this, obviously, and where I learned
Great for
a lot about
practicing.
leadership. Yeah, that's right. A lot about leadership. But similarly, going into school and school holiday programs around the traps. I grew up in a pretty working class area in Housing Commission area in a very small regional town in New South Wales called Cessnock. It's a pretty rough and tumble place, and my parents were nurses, so it was back in the 70s when you didn't really have very much resources other than that imagination and the ability to create something from nothing. And I guess my leadership journey started quite early, and I always was able to, Karen, think about or anchor in the future an idea for what to do, what to create, something new, how to change, and then work away with others to make that happen, or some semblance of it, I imagine, looking back on.
So were you aware about of that and that ability at the time? Was it something that you could speak about in some way, or is it now later you can kind of look back and see, yes, that's what I was doing?
I think at the time I didn't necessarily have the literacy for it, but I was always, you know, even from, I'm trying to think, like maybe year one or year two, I was become the bus monitor, and I always had one boy at the top of my list every day. He didn't even have to be on the bus to be at the top of the list, etc. I was very much into that, wanting to take a leadership role, very actively a part of that. So I think just my natural approach to that, rather than having the literacy about it. I did want to lead, and I did find, certainly in my high school years, a real frustration that I wasn't seen in that way by others, in the way that I saw myself. And that was a real interesting sort of identity tension there, that why am I not looked upon in the way that I understand myself, the way that I have understood myself over that childhood period.
So that's a very interesting realization to come to. And what did you try to change that?
In those kind of teenage years, I think, you know, there's a lot going on, isn't there? And I think rather than trying to change that because of the social system in which you are and where you sit in the pecking order, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to change that, that it really was thinking about how am I just going to play the long game, really think about where I wanted to go. And I had a really strong feeling and idea from, I think, like year 10 or even year 9, Karen, where I had picked out the course I wanted to do at university, and I just, that was the only one I applied for. I was going to get into it. Very determined character from a young age.
Yeah, and so after school and thinking about what you wanted to do and being very clear about it, how did that leadership story then progress?
Well, in fact, I did get into that program. It was talent-based entry, and I think it really started to set a bit of an understanding for me around, you know, how these institutions called universities work and how they can see, well, in that particular instance, talent, what it means to them as compared to assessing young people, especially against a very standardised number that you might achieve for your end of high school scores. And that really kind of asserted in my mind about how institutions needed to change and needed to be thinking about it. And I think through my university days, it was I did theatre, improvisational theatre, again, really hugging that idea of creating something out of nothing, imagination, working in a team, collaborating, always kind of saying yes and let's rather than no. And a lot of that kind of methodology, a way of thinking about the world and creating things in a work environment, has really served me very well. And it's kind of set up, I think, a real methodology for the way in which I have gone on to work, whether it be, it certainly moved on from the arts into academia and business and all sorts of different areas. But those ways of working with people were really well set, I think, in my early university days. And I was very young. I went to university at the age of 17, and so I was quite young, truly just trying to work out who I was, but still giving a lot of things a go, getting involved in student politics, getting involved in radio, getting involved in advocacy work, and really trying out my way of working and my way of understanding the world in so many different areas. And it was excellent time.
And what was that course that you chose?
It was a Bachelor of Communications in Theatre and Media. And you know, I love it. I still talk to the people who run the program, and there's quite a truly defined sort of alumni of that program, the theatre sort of mafia, if you will, and who have gone all sorts of which ways, but very involved in a lot of independent theatre and circus and all of that across Australia and internationally. So it was such a great time. I just loved that course. I loved the way that it was set up, and I guess I have talked about it before, Karen, that they. The way the people who constructed that program really did think about belonging, and that was a really key part, not only to my leadership journey in education, but for all the people who went through that program, where first years had to do like this, you know, 2-day trek up a massive kind of hill. And they had to be, you were in groups of like 5 people. You've only known them for 2 weeks, and you've got a backpack, you're out to camp. But when you arrive at the camp, there was all the third years, and they had made a beautiful camp for you, and they did a beautiful performance on the river to help you let go of your fears that night as a starting point for the course. And then the second years were at the top of the hill celebrating your achievement. And it was
wow.
Just an incredible moment. You knew after doing it in your first year, like it was such a crucible moment, that and it, not an initiation in a terrible way, but a coming
no, in a very positive
family
way.
Right? And you
yeah,
knew
yeah,
what
yeah.
you know, oh, next year I'm going to be that crew, or third year I'm going to be these ones. And that real sense of intergenerationality became an imprint that I've been able to draw upon across my career.
Oh, yeah, what a very respectful and warm way to welcome people into a program. That's, yeah, sounds absolutely wonderful. Great, great learning opportunity.
Yeah.
Okay, and from there you graduated, and what came next?
Yeah, well, you know, I thought I was eminently employable, Karen. I had a Bachelor of Communications in Theatre and Media, but this was at the time of the Howard government and the Dole diary and all of these sort of things, and I found myself unemployed or having a few kind of art projects that I was trying to work on. I started working with young people who with disabilities and teaching radio and setting up a radio program, and oh gosh, it was just super fun. And that's when I started getting into community-based arts development work, working with so many different communities, from women unionists to people living in caravan parks to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, gay and lesbian community, on all sorts of different projects that were using the arts as the sort of vehicle for social change or some sort of advocacy movement that they were involved in. And so that became kind of my interest area over the next few years. I was able to set up my own big project back in my hometown of Cessnock, which was a women's writing and storytelling project, because it's such a men's history of that particular town as a mining town. And it was really, you know, it taught me a lot about the power of impact through projects, and also I think the overreach that people setting up projects or doing short-term projects with community, perhaps tend to have. They think that the project is going to have such a deep impact on people ongoing. But I went back 5 years after to this project, Karen, when I was doing my master's degree, to ask that question about, you know, what are have been the long-term impacts. And one lady, just one of the participants, kind of said, well, what do you think we've been doing? Like, we've lived our lives. This was such a small a blip on the radar. Like, what are you expecting? And it was just such a fantastic kind of wake-up moment, I think, especially that thing that organisations and certainly the arts, but also business, talk about, you know, having to prove impact. And, you know, well, what about the whole context? How does it fit in people's lives? And are you so arrogant as to think, you know, such a thing can have enduring impact? What are we expecting? And so it made me much more critical about the whole evaluation space.
Yes, and yet if we're spending our time and think we're serving communities in some kind of way, we want to make some kind of difference. And that's why, you know, when, you know, one of the things I do, work with people around their purpose, everybody wants to make a difference. So I think it's interesting to be able to balance that. What's my need and how do I want to have an impact with what's happening for you and the sort of impact that you have. So what are your reflections on how you do manage yourself around that, but without limiting what's possible?
That's it, isn't it? It's really being aware of your own needs and appetites for wanting to be a certain way or be seen as a certain type of leader or have an impact, and it really just kind of almost, it was a fantastic wake-up call to me to pay attention to that sort of reflexivity part of the practice, and it just really set me onto a different way of approaching the work that I was doing, where I really was trying to pay attention to what I'm, you know, am I desperately trying to achieve something? Am I, what is this about for me? What's my role in this? What's at stake for me? And trying to be really just careful about imprinting what I wanted onto other things, because, you know, I am a determined character. I'm indefatigable, really, in a lot of ways, able to continue on in service to this kind of higher order goal or mission or legacy, whatever project or program or center you might be doing. So that became my fascination, I guess, around understanding the work of leadership, the practice of it, and the actual work that is involved in leadership.
And I'd love to hear insights around that in general, or just as you continue to tell your story and bring it to the present moment.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, you know, after my work in the community, I was able to, I worked out that this kind of word I didn't have on my CV, management, means that I wasn't getting jobs. I could do all sorts of things. I just didn't have that word. And it was at the time that arts management courses were really starting to pop up, and one of the first ones in our country was the one at the Victorian College of the Arts, and I was lucky enough to get into it back in the late 90s and move to Melbourne and do that course and start to work in community radio again there, which had been my passion, and I was able to work for 3CR and be a part of the founding of Three Cool and Deadly, Melbourne's Indigenous radio station, and really start to become a part of the Melbourne Indigenous community in so many ways and be a part of supporting so many different artists and community people. I mean, it was just such a great time about how we could all come together to create this new organisation and have a voice as a community. And I wanted to do more and more of that work and found myself teaching at Swinburne briefly in Indigenous Performing Arts and then at the Victorian College of the Arts as a student support officer for the Indigenous artists who were training there. And of course, VCA is also talent-based entry. And I was kind of perplexed when I started that work that there was only 4 Indigenous artists training, because I was thinking, well, the barriers to entry less so because it's not about a number on your high school certificate. It is about your talent. And I had just spent, you know, years working with incredibly talented artists, and why weren't there more people? So we really worked on that idea about participation and access, and were able to, you know, increase student numbers from 4 to 20 within a 2-year time period, and just by making it a more open place to come. It is a very elite institution, and and that's where the kind of big barrier to entry to these sort of institutions, I think, and what has been my experience, is it not having an Indigenous kind of place to come and together, not just as students, but then with community and with artists and the whole ecosystem. And that's where the idea of establishing the Willen Centre for Indigenous Arts and Cultural Development arose. And I was able to do that hand in hand with senior elder for the Wurundjeri, Aunty Joy Wanda Murphy, and a bunch of incredible Indigenous cultural mentors to me, like Kuchera and Ron Murray and Ian Anderson from the University of Melbourne, and create that space. And it was a really incredible time about building the careers of individual artists through the training program, but also creating a space to think about, you know, where people weren't participating and what we could do to create new spaces. And one of the kind of really interesting projects was I had Deborah Cheatham arrive on campus as a deputy principal at the Victorian College of the Arts Secondary School. And we talked in her first week where she had a vision for establishing an Indigenous opera, first ever, and using language. And I was just like, oh, wow, that is what needs to happen. I'm like, how do you do that? You need singers. Who are the opera singers? If you're the only one, how are we going to create this? We're going to have to create a whole generation. We're going to have to train people. We're going to have to, you know. And so we set about doing that project. I was supporting her. She was really leading it. And, you know, just that idea of being able to commission and to support new emerging talent, and certainly those sort of structures that have gone on to be incredibly prolific in the Indigenous arts space for Australia. So that was the kind of next big step on my career journey. And I guess the change to leadership really came through my teaching, Karen. I was teaching Indigenous arts management with a whole bunch of really interesting Indigenous artists and Indigenous arts managers. Trying to figure out, you know, how do we grow this kind of pot of incredible people? And as we were doing it over 5 years, I found that the work they were doing was not managerial, but not necessarily completely. It was actually leadership work, and I went looking
Right, yeah.
for sort of texts or what works to introduce to them to have that leadership conversation, and there was hardly anything there. And so I
Yeah.
decided to go on a PhD journey and write that up specifically for that group of people. So my thesis was about Indigenous arts leadership, in fact. And the only place you could study leadership was in a business school, which I
Yeah.
thought was so strange. And I had never been to the business school at
Or
Melbourne.
education schools, or nobody else, no
Nobody
other
I
place for it.
tried. Yeah, I
Yeah,
really did.
I'm sure. Yeah, that's, I'm
And
sure
look,
you did.
I had heard this name of Amanda Sinclair for a long, long
Sinclair,
time, so many places, and I thought, oh
yeah.
well, just meet this person. And gosh, yeah, amazing. She listened to me, Karen, for about, I don't know how long I yarned for, and very patiently. And then she said, oh, read my book, which she had just written, Leadership for the Disillusioned. And
Illusioned, yeah.
I
Not
came
what you're
back.
expecting, was it?
I came back a couple of
The
weeks later and
illusion.
went, that's what I mean. And she's like, I know that's what you mean. And we developed a really strong relationship. And I did my PhD through the Melbourne Business School. But again, of course, I couldn't just study. I was working full time. But I needed to make that paradigm shift from the arts to business. And it was really
Yeah.
hard for me, from a mental
Yeah.
model, I guess, and a psychological perspective. Like, it took a lot of effort. It didn't feel right. It was an identity shift, really.
Shift, yeah. Why did you need to make that? Was it because you were studying in a business school and therefore your PhD just had to be focused around business? It couldn't be around kind of leadership in art.
Well, it was around leadership and arts, but because I was finding myself in the actual place of the business school, and I was trying to understand, leadership theory, and a lot of it, as you know, is bound in the management and business sciences. I thought, I've got to really, really try to understand this. And look, the only way that I could really understand it my own self was through Indigenous artists who were kind of exploring this world of, it was a new term back then for that space, which was about being an entrepreneur. And
Right, yeah.
at that
Right,
time,
yeah.
I met Professor Ian Williamson, who was at the Melbourne Business School, who's an African American scholar and teacher. And he was very passionate about Aboriginal business also. And so together, we banged our heads together to think of a way to bring more Aboriginal people into the business school. And that was,
School, yes.
no, let's create a program for Indigenous business leaders. And
Yeah.
we set up the Murra program
Right.
in 2012.
Yeah. So I just celebrated a decade of the
I
Mara program.
celebrated a decade. Gosh,
Congratulations. That's
such
amazing.
a joy. It's such a joy of a program. And, it really became a way to explore how this crew of people are a generation of change themselves, learning this language of business, but also a new literacy around Indigenous business leadership and what that means, and try out different social claims around that. And that's just been a joy to be a part of. And it's been so generative, Karen, not only for me, but for, I hope, all of the alumni and teaching staff who have been involved and partners. There's just been such a lot of give where we've been able to do research and we've inspired collective movements like Indigenous Business Month. There's been students who have gone on to create junior Murra programs or Indigenous women
right.
in programs or Black coffee program across Australia. I mean, it's incredible, this feeling of what that alumni is able to do, not just individually, but as a collective force for leadership. And that's become a real interest area of mine, is around the collective leadership possibilities. And I think, you know, as Murra worked and as these things kind of were being generated out of the energy of the program and everyone involved, that has birthed this new centre, which is the Dylan Dua Centre for Indigenous Business Leadership. And it really has become, it was a dream of the alumni. The alumni came together like 2009, I think, oh no, 2019, to talk about an academy for this thought leadership and what they wanted, and talked about what they would like in a centre. And that's what we've used as the template to create the centre that we have now.
Yeah. So thinking back to around 2012 or so, you're in the throes of the PhD and figuring out how your ideas get the fit in a particular academic context, or change the academic context to fit the ideas. And then there's the birth of this program, thinking about, you know, your idea of carving out a future. Is this what you wanted? Is this what you were thinking of? Has that been fulfilled?
Oh, absolutely, and more so. And that's the most interesting or exciting part for me, is that I've tried to learn from those early days to temper my ambition, still very ambitious, but in concert and in collective with the view of the group that we've been working with over the past 10 years. And I mean, there are some times, Karen, where I have to go out ahead, like we've done, I think, around the data project work, where we're trying to establish a national data infrastructure for the Indigenous business sector so that we can talk about how much contribution Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people make to the Australian economy, rather than just sitting in the discourse of closing the gap. I think we need both parts of that coin spoken about, but it's very difficult to do so when you don't have the quantitative data to do so. And I'm not a quantitative person, but I am good at collaboration. I can establish something. I'm quite good at seeing how it could work in the future, and or even just, you know, being able to create the partnership to make it happen. And so there are points where I need to go ahead, but it's always as a way to draw forward. And sometimes I'm too far behind on something, and the group will draw me forward or us forward.
I mean, part of the whole dilemma or challenge of leadership is, I mean, what you're talking so thoughtfully about, this where am I and where's everybody else? You know, I'm drawing ahead, I'm coming back, where are they? It's much more about that, you know, adaptive opportunity to move the system rather than standing out from the system and being the leader. And, you know, I suppose in non-Indigenous ways of thinking about leadership in particular, there's a very strong focus often on the individual. But myself, I tend to disagree with that. It's about how people move. It's very hard to find the language to speak to that differently. So tell us a bit about Dylan Dua, then let's talk about what we non-Indigenous leaders, like myself and others, can actually learn from, your story, your experience, but in particular that Indigenous way of leading.
Yeah, so just a few words on Dylan Dua. Dylan Dua is a phrase of the Woiwurrung language, which is the language of the Wurundjeri people, one of the five tribes of the Kulin Nation based around Melbourne they're out from there. And in talking with the elders and the Wurundjeri Land Council and Aunty Gail, we settled on this particular phrase, which is Dylan Dua, meaning everlasting flow. And we're really trying to create this idea of that limitless idea of flow between a whole range of work that might be happening in concert with each other, in tandem, alongside, in with dissonance, but there is a flow between it. So the university research centres kind of tend to be a conservative type of model, and certainly at the University of Melbourne, there's a real focus on, these three streams of work: research, teaching and learning, and then what they've called in the past knowledge transfer, but we are calling community engagement. And I guess it's our work with our other co-founder, Melbourne Business School, that's really a part of that. So Dylan Dua sits in between the University of Melbourne's Faculty of Business and Economics and the Melbourne Business School. It is a quite a unique model with an Indigenous advisory group made up of our alumni and some of our Indigenous business sector leaders to really provide that strategic advice and review as a house of review for the strategy that Dylan Dua is working towards. So we have a range of research projects, a lot, but our big flagship one is setting up this national data infrastructure around Indigenous economy and trying to build or make a contribution to some of the thinking around in Indigenous economy and economic contribution. So that's been really something I never imagined myself involved with at all, talking into spaces like, the Reserve Bank of Australia or these different places altogether, but it is incredible to be able to span all of these places. Our teaching program, of course, our premier program is the Murra program, but also we've built out a postgraduate offering to be a stepping stone for people into further degrees if that's possible. And I think that graduate certificate in Indigenous business leadership is just a beautiful thing. We've been able to build a membership for Dylan Dua across the world with Indigenous business scholars and practitioners, and invite them to develop an online subject offering about that centers on their research passion that they may never get the opportunity to teach into in their business school in America or Canada or New Zealand, right? So we've got people from all over the world teaching into that program, and it's so cool. And then our community engagement stream is very much the, I think, the real it provides such a great fertilizer for everything else. It's really about connecting with business owners and leaders and community groups, country in regional Australia, and democratizing business education regionally to remote Australia, whether it's through taking programs into places via invitation or doing things online. So I think, you know, we're really interested in all of that. And as you can imagine, it has got that deal and doer across it.
But that sounds huge.
Yes.
You're a big centre.
Yes.
Or big vision.
That'll be that one. We're going to be big.
But, yes.
You can't start too small.
Love it. Love it. Okay. And yeah, non-Indigenous leaders, what have we got to learn?
Well, I think, you
Where
know.
Where do I start, she says.
I think thinking about the, you know, the place that you are doing leadership from, being able to understand the place, the context, and how it's interconnected with what's possible in your leadership movement. I think a lot of the time when we go about the work of leadership, we're highly up in our minds and we're in the future thinking about things. And how do you stay connected to the now, to the place, to the people of the place, and be able to boundary span between those two pieces? I see Indigenous leaders being able to hold that deep understanding of time between the past, the present, and the future in such a sophisticated manner. And what we do know from leadership theory, as you've probably talked a lot about it, in that sort of adaptive leadership approach, is that experiences of those crucible experiences that people have really create an understanding or a need to really examine who you are and how you're leading. For Indigenous leaders, this is just it's just the operating kind of principles for our lives. All at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's lives is that they are working across at least two cultural contexts, if not more, and definitely across languages. So the adaptivity of those leaders to be able to think in different ways, to be able to find a way to span between requirements and understand the language and the value add between, it is a super leadership work or value that they are able to bring. And I think that we can really learn from that, trying to think about, you know, not just about how you can develop something and bring it to the world, but how it sits in an ecosystem and how you working with a bigger collective of people. What is the what's at stake here, and what's the aim of it, and how does it move the needle on X, Y, Z, whatever you're doing? These are just natural parts of the way of thinking for Aboriginal Australia, because there is a real collective goal here that is held, which is about future generations and cultural survival. It is about sovereignty and self-determination. There is such collective goals. But for non-Indigenous Australia, where the diversity is more so, what trying to key into that is so helpful, because then you're not just alone.
Yeah, there's a few things in that that are just, you know, triggering all sorts of thoughts. I mean, to keep things in a sense quite prosaic, I think one of the reasons a lot of organizations and leaders are struggling now, the whole hybrid work, and you know, we have to work in the office or not in the office, seems to me that there's a lot of, there's boundary spanning in that. How do you boundary span across different places? As well as different needs and interests. And that idea of kind of past, present, future seems to underlie that in a way that I'm not quite sure that I can articulate. But what it seems to me is that it's a wonderful fluidity or flowing or flexibility of where you stand in time, which makes a huge difference to the sorts of options that you can see. If you can hold things from different perspectives, you can create different kinds of options and you can be in different places, I suppose, and understand how you're showing up in different places. And that idea of the bigger goal that's about more about you, more than about you, but it is about future generations of leaders. I mean, they're just three incredibly powerful messages that I think have a lot of weight and value for non-Indigenous leaders to be kind of thinking about how they might hone those capabilities. Obviously, there's a lot in there that's about discomfort, isn't there? That's those sorts of things, boundary spanning, well, and the cruel challenges that people face are uncomfortable, but they're kind of necessary for growth.
Yes. And it keeps you accountable when you're thinking about, you know, how does the work that we're doing impact? It's not just about this organization and achieving XYZ. It is about this organization and who it serves and what it is more a part of. And I think, you know, to your point on the online and on country, this way we think about Deal and Doer too is because we do have people who work from different parts of Australia. So we're kind of online, we're on country, and sometimes we're on campus, you know, we're across all these different spaces. And it would be silly to think that it doesn't make an impact interpersonally in the team dynamics about having people in different places and the expectation, especially on people who are in the office and keeping that home fire burning and having to do a lot of that doing in the real world, if it is, you know, compared to people who are, you know, off campus and maybe doing different type of work, and how you navigate that interpersonal tensions as well as the work requirements and keep accountable to each other. It is a real leadership challenge.
I think there's a lot of learning that there's a lot of people in particular management roles in organizations are really needing to do around how they pay attention to those important things.
That's right.
So as we finish up, Michelle, that's been, you know, fantastic to hear that story and all of that sense of kind of certainty about where you wanted to go. I usually finish these conversations with, you know, key messages that you would like to pass on to newer or emerging leaders. But I'm a bit tempted to divert from that. And just what's the future for Michelle Evans?
I don't know, Karen, you know, and maybe I'm a bit uncomfortable about that as I like a little bit of a surety and certainty. I mean, I think I can see a decade ahead at least of how much change will be upon us with the establishment, hopefully, of a voice to the Constitution, and with treaty making happening across Australia, with a truth-telling commission and the reparations that will flow from that, the amendments around rules in terms of prioritising Indigenous businesses in the procurement and supply chains of our businesses, some business, big corporates going post reconciliation action plans and what that means. There's a lot of flux ahead. And I think especially around the enactment of, you know, inherent right to negotiate by First Nations communities and traditional owners and native title owners, that shift into really driving the economic power agenda of Indigenous Australia will just be ramping up over the next decade. And I think we will be of such, we will be delighted to be on that journey and to support Indigenous business leaders who are doing that hard work on the day-to-day basis, because they are at the cultural interface of really difficult systems that are pushing and hurting individuals who are carrying a massive cultural load. And I think, you know, the next decade ahead with the energy transition, like there's just such change, isn't there, that we need. Everything needs to change from a business school perspective. Is what we're teaching relevant anymore? How do we change that? So everyone is going to have to rewrite their ship. And again, we will just look to and keep in dialogue with our alumni and the sector and broader to make sure that what we're thinking and what we're offering is of value right now.
That's fantastic. It sounds like a huge future ahead. And it sounds like you're just the right person with the right determination and ambition, as well as all this brilliant experience to help guide that shift. Thank you so much for the conversation. I've really enjoyed it. There's a lot to think about and digest, and all the very best for that challenging future ahead.
Thanks, Karen.